It's taken several years to get to this point, but the city of Hammond's now getting ready to start building a 135,000 square foot sports complex on what many people know as the old Woodmar Mall. The Carson store is going to stay. With us to talk about what's planned for the Woodmar neighborhood is Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. Mr. Mayor, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Pretty good. Tell us the planning now up to this point that is going to bring us to the construction of the sportsplex.
I'm a baseball coach, so I don't really know a lot about basketball, AAU, travel basketball, travel volleyball, and soccer. I've always focused on baseball myself, but I remember reading an article in the paper one day when the field house in Maryville closed down. And it was an article basically like eulogizing the field house and wondering what the future of the region was going to be for travel basketball, because the, you know, that field house in Maryville filled such a huge void. So that's where I got the idea initially, was, wow, we should really try to, you know, replace, you know, what the field house offered, and maybe these regional teams will come to Hammond, you know. And that's how it started off. And, you know, in my courses of traveling with my travel team, I went down to Westville, Indiana, which is a mecca for amateur sports. And, you know, I just saw what they were doing down there with amateur sports, and I became very interested. And it sort of morphed it, you know, the idea to replace the field house sort of morphed into this idea that we want a big facility in Hammond that's going to attract teams from all over the Midwest to come to Hammond for a weekend tournament. And obviously, if we're going to get people to travel that far, we want to have a quality product. And, you know, and we came up with this idea, which is a 17,135,000 square foot facility that'll house six indoor basketball, volleyball courts, and we could expand up to eight also if we need a tournament big enough like that, or mm-hmm. two indoor soccer fields, and you could do both tournaments at the same time. So one side will be soccer, one side will be basketball or volleyball.
Now, what will the facility look like when you travel along Indianapolis Boulevard there in the neighborhood before you get to 165th there, in the neighborhood of the Woodmar, where the Woodmar Mall used to be? And I know for a long, long time that there have been work efforts, unsuccessful ones, unfortunately, to try to develop the properties where the old mall buildings used to stand, and now only the Carson Peary Scott store is standing. What's it going to look like around that area there now, when it's all
complete? Well, when you're coming north on the boulevard, you'll come up to 167th, which is where a lot of people used to enter the mall from, right by the old Kenny Shoes down there. And where it'll be, the new facility will be located right off 167th, and it'll extend north towards Carson Prairie Scott. And we made it so both of the buildings peacefully coexist with each other. But basically, it'll go up. It won't physically touch the Carson Prairie Scott, but they'll be pretty close to each other. And, you know, if Carson Prairie stays Carson Prairie, that's great. If not, it could be like a Dick's Sporting Goods or something along those lines. But these two buildings are meant to coexist with each other. Parking will be on both sides of the building. And we anticipate, you know, we're going to hopefully get in ground and start building it in May of this year. And, you know, and about a year later, it should be completed. So
when we're talking about parking spaces, you're talking about, of course, enough to not only still handle the parking that handles it for the Carson store itself, and not going to interfere with the sportsplex itself?
Carson's parking will be on the north and the south as it currently is, and this sportsplex will be very busy on the weekends. Mm-hmm. We anticipate, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights, it'll be more geared towards Hammond residents, you know, maybe local, you know, adult leagues and stuff like that. But Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, this is going to be a regional asset. And, you know, we expect to see a lot of license plates from outside of, you know, Indiana parked in our parking lot, and hopefully rejuvenate the economic development in that whole area. And we'll know if we start to see a lot of restaurants opening, which I, you know, if I had an extra $1 million in my pocket and wanted to open a restaurant, that's an area I'd be looking to.
Because
when your team is playing in these tournaments and you may have a game that just ends and you have a two-hour break and you have another game, they're looking for quick food, someplace to sit down and get away from for a couple, you know, couple minutes, and then head back over to the tournament site.
When you're talking about a facility that big, how much is it going to cost, and how's it going to be paid for?
Well, the beautiful part is I've been there 13 years now, and we have options in Hammond through the federal government. Probably President Trump will be eliminated very soon, but thankfully for us, we already committed through HUD to receive a $10 million loan from them for this facility, and that'll get over 50% of the total cost paid for, and the other $7 million we're going to probably have to come up with ourselves, and we will. So the whole project will cost around $17 million, but over half of it will be paid for by an interest-free loan from the federal government.
Now, you mentioned the construction's scheduled to start sometime during the spring months and in about a year or so to complete. How quickly do you think it's going to take, how quickly do you think it's going to be, before you actually start seeing teams play in the facility? Are there any efforts even underway now to try to line up venues for the big building once it opens up for business?
I can tell there's a lot of excitement. I've already received about 10 applications from people that want to run the facility, which is funny. It's not even, we haven't even put one shovel in the ground, and people are already dropping resumes on me because it's an exciting prospect. I mean, we're talking about, I need somebody that's creative, somebody that understands both sides, you know, the soccer, the volleyball, and the basketball, the ability to promote and pull, you know, teams from all over the Midwest into that facility because we want it busy every weekend. I can tell you that the busy time off, obviously, will be during the winter. So we imagine by the winter of 2018, we'll be up and running full steam. Hopefully, maybe next summer, you know, we get in there and, you know, we can mess around a little bit. But in the summertime, most people don't want to go indoors to play, you know, sports. So they'll be playing outdoor soccer at that point. They'll be, you know, doing other things besides basketball and volleyball. But by the time the fall of 2018 rolls around, we'll be ready to go full steam.
Do you think that maybe during those summer months that you might be able to attract some convention business, so to speak, athletic-related convention business into the site itself? Because you've had this nice
it's
big
certainly
building.
Big enough. Yeah. It's certainly big enough. The basketball side, you keep in mind that the soccer side is going to be turf, you know. So, but on the basketball, but we also have the ability to build basketball courts into the turf side if we had a big enough tournament. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we needed eight courts, we could do it. But on the basketball side, you know, it's at least 60,000-70,000 square feet of space, so we could do things over there. And another cool feature we added for the local community is at the old Woodmar Mall, a lot of our senior groups like to get into the mall and just walk around the mall. And, you know, obviously when the mall went away, so did that walking club that used to exist over there. We included a quarter mile elevated walking track in this facility where you could, you know, go in there and do laps or you could watch the events from up there as well. So that's a nice little touch we added.
That's great. We're talking with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. about the proposed Sportsplex, a huge facility that is going to be built on the land that is now formerly the Woodmar Shopping Mall on Indianapolis Boulevard and 167th. You'll be seeing a big building going up here in the months during the summer, and plans about a year from now to have it ready for occupancy by sports teams, not only local teams, but teams coming into town as well, too. Mr. Mayor, let's talk a little bit here about how things are happening with the Hammond Sanitary District, while we have a chance to get the update here. We know that the city has signed the consent decree with both the U.S. EPA as well as with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management to try to deal with the issues of sewage overflows that are going from the sewage treatment plant into both of the Calumet Rivers, Little and Grand. What's the update on that and how you're trying to work things out with our communities around Hammond to work this out?
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, we're the last Indiana community, I believe, to sign our consent decree with the federal government. And we signed it with the Obama administration literally as they were walking out the door. So I think they were happy that we finally signed. And the reason we did sign is because, we had literally hundreds of clean water violations that they were holding over our head. And if we didn't sign the consent decree, they would have prosecuted those clean water violations, which would have resulted in litigation and possibly, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands in fines. So we signed the consent decree. We settled our case with IDEM, with the U.S. EPA. And now we're waiting for what's called a long-term control plan to be approved by the federal government. This is where things get complicated, though, because now that we've had a change in administration and a president that really doesn't believe, like President Obama did, in the EPA, Hammond's really in a good position. The new EPA, who knows what their view is on long-term control plans, but we'll be one of the first communities they review. And if they change their tune, it could mean a huge savings for the customers of the Hammond Sanitary District.
We're finding that I know you're trying to work things out with communities around that take advantage of the Hammond Sanitary District to take care of their wastewater treatment facilities overflow into that will end up, of course, getting into the lake. Are there any more discussions, any breakthroughs, so
no,
to speak?
We're in really good shape, actually. We've, you know, 5 years ago, there was huge litigation between the town of Whiting, there's the city of Whiting, the town of Highland, and the town of Griffith had all sued the Hammond Sanitary District, which is composed of Munster and Hammond, and it was, you know, millions of dollars in litigation fees, and finally we settled our case, and we've worked with these communities. We worked really closely with Rick Rifa over there in the town of Griffith, and we worked real closely with Michael Griffin and Bernie Zeman and, you know, in the town of Highland, and we've come up with fair proposals for both communities, where they get something from us and we got, you know, a little bit more money from them. What we're really worried about is, you know, the help from our customer communities to pay for the capital improvements that are going to eventually be required under our long-term control plan. We didn't feel it's fair for Hammond residents and Munster residents to bear the burden of a regional capital improvement like the wastewater facility.
Mayor McDermott, thanks very much for the updates, and we appreciate it. We're looking forward to the groundbreaking ceremonies for the new Sportsplex there along Indianapolis Boulevard in Hammond, and appreciate you talking about it today.
It's my pleasure. It's nice talking to you, and look forward to the next time.
Rural homeowners in one Indiana county say a big nearby hog farm, a concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO as they're called, is hurting their property values. But the officials in that county deny the residents' request to lower the CAFO neighbors' property taxes, saying that the issue is too complex to codify. Residents say that officials are just worried about politics and money. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports that the truth may be somewhere in between.
Bartholomew County Assessor Lou Wilson has spent months working on property tax appeals with half a dozen residents in the tiny town of Hope. His job was to help county appeals officials decide if the residents were right, that their homes should be worth less and their taxes lowered because they live near a CAFO.
We looked at these all together because we thought we had one problem. But really what we have is six people who have individual situations.
Wilson and his colleagues had hoped to devise a broader solution, an ordinance or change to county law, that would automatically lower the value of a house near a CAFO. This would have set a statewide precedent. But he says the law couldn't just be about distance.
You've got the lay of the land. You also have people who might be more sensitive than others. You know, there's so many subjective things. And whenever you get into subjective items, it becomes more difficult. And then when you have several subjective items, it's even more difficult after that.
It's not so subjective to people like Al Heber, an agricultural engineer at Purdue University.
Whenever there's a controversy, I usually get calls. People download from both sides of the issue. They will download my model to see what my model says in terms of distance.
Heber's widely used computer model devises setbacks for houses near CAFOs, how far they have to be before the smell of thousands of animals and manure isn't overwhelming.
Okay, so here's the model, and it's a spreadsheet with different tabs. The first tab...
Anyone can use this spreadsheet to plug in numbers, locations, and geological features. We tried it out in Heber's office at Purdue, using his own house in Delphi and a hypothetical nearby CAFO to fill in the variables.
Okay, now I'm going down here, and I just have a few more choices. First of all, I can ask, is the terrain very similar around all directions, or do we need to choose a different one for each direction?
The model is pre-programmed with the impacts of different animals, wind data from every Indiana weather station, and the effects of abatement tools like trees or ventilation filters. When we're all done, it gives us an ideal separation between the CAFO and the house.
So on the average, my setback is 1,133 feet, or 0.21 miles. Away from the facility.
It shows this with a rough circle around the CAFO, outside which Heber says residents are pretty reliably safe from odor. Some counties have even used this process in creating their setback rules. And Heber says he could adapt the model to talk about property values with the right data. But that data doesn't really exist. For one thing, property values are driven by sales, and many real estate agents say homes near CAFOs just aren't selling. Either way, Heber says you'd need a lot of expensive multidisciplinary research to pin down a variable for the model that describes property value impacts. And all that makes it hard to regulate.
It's difficult to do when you don't have the data to back it up. But it wouldn't be the first time that regulations are put in place without science to back them up.
Assessor Lou Wilson doesn't want to take that chance.
We're going to deal with it on an individual basis with an individual situation. And that's how I finally determined is the only way that I think I can settle these equitably.
The residents he's been working with think that's not the only reason. Nancy Banta, whose family home in Hope is just half a mile from the CAFO, says the county is worried about losing tax revenue and wading into politically thorny territory.
If they start doing it with me, what's going to happen is they're going to have to do it with a lot of people. That's what they're afraid of.
She hopes she and her neighbors will have better luck setting a precedent, even one by one, when they appeal their cases to the State Board of Tax Review. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Not long ago, the website The Conversation had an article on how companies can stay ahead of the cybersecurity curve. It was written by our next guest, Assistant Professor of Business Law and Ethics at the Kelly School of Business at IU in Bloomington, Scott Shackelford. He's with us. Scott, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. It's a pleasure.
What seems to be the big concern these days? Obviously, there's always been a big concern, and it's been heightened since the war on terror seemed to have begun, concerning cybersecurity. But we seem to find more and more businesses being badly hacked. One of the biggest, I know, examples in recent years has been Google and Yahoo, and they've still, I guess, reeling from some of their problems here. What in the research that you've done, that you wrote about in the article, seem to be the problem that companies are running into these days, and how are they dealing with this?
Yeah, you pretty much named the company at this point, and they have been breached at some point, including Google in a cyber attack you might remember called Operation Aurora back in 2010, where attackers went after their kind of crown jewels, their core search algorithm. So this is a problem for the big companies like Yahoo, like Google, and also for small and medium-sized companies. Even local governments at this point have been targeted with ransomware that can encrypt their systems unless they pay a ransom in Bitcoin. So this is a problem kind of across the board, one that you're right has been building a lot in recent years, but one that we're still trying to get right in terms of risk mitigation best practices. But the good news is that some companies are starting to get that mix right, and we're starting to see some improvement, which I'd be happy to talk about.
I know that the idea of cyber problems by companies they might seem to be talked about until it's so bad and it's affected so many users of whatever the service happens to be that they have to tell the public. It seems not necessarily a secret, but it is not very well known, I imagine, for some cases here.
Yeah, you're right. So it's the case at this point that across the country we have 47 different data breach notification laws. So it's really a patchwork. So depending on where you're doing business, where you happen to be located, that can really impact the type of information you have to disclose and how quickly you have to disclose it after a major cyber attack or breach. Companies that, of course, do business across a lot of those jurisdictions, that can get pretty complicated pretty quickly.
What seems to be the best way that managers are trying to recognize that they're not alone, that there are a lot of companies out there that have been pretty badly hacked, they've had some damage, and maybe they're reeling from the problems that their particular company is having here, but what ways, you talk about standard of care, what is that and how establishing a better standard of care will help mitigate, if not eliminate, maybe some of the problems that cybersecurity problems have?
Yeah, there we kind of simplify this in terms of the three B's. So we encourage companies to be organized, to be aware in terms of what the cyber threat is and how it impacts their particular business, and just to be proactive, right, to kind of lean in here and not be reactive. And try to fix things after the fact, but to try to do that at the outset. There's some really simple things that companies should be doing to begin with, and a lot more are these days, which is a great news. So, for example, having a game plan, which is called an incident response plan. So knowing what you're going to do after a major breach, who's responsible, who's going to collaborate with law enforcement, all that can be incredibly important before the fact. And then kind of moving beyond that, making sure your organization is set up to be able to respond appropriately to a breach. So is there a chief information security officer, right? Sony, for example, didn't have one of those on staff when it was breached in 2011. It did by 2014, but it was still breached again. So that in and of itself isn't enough, but it's a positive step in the right direction. And then you got to be proactive. So, you know, for example, some companies that might have a cyber risk insurance policy, I think they're covered and might not make those more proactive investments. It's that old problem of moral hazard kind of in the cyber context. So, you know, those are some easy steps you can take. And you're right. You pointed to the standard of care. And that's something that we're starting to see emerging based on some cybersecurity frameworks that are being put out. And that's a really positive development. We're starting to see that more and more with companies kind of checking their own practices against this common framework. And over time, we think that's going to help establish a baseline that'll help move the ball forward here.
We're talking with IU Kelley School of Business in Bloomington, Assistant Professor of Business Law and Ethics, Scott Shackelford. He had a recent article in The Conversation online talking about the issue of how companies can best prepare for, if they can, or at least try and stay ahead of the cybersecurity curve. Scott, let's talk a little bit about regulations now from the state level, from the federal level. What are the governments offering up here to encourage companies to be smart and put in the practices that you've talked about here that will keep them safe as far as cybersecurity is concerned?
Well, for quite some time now, it shouldn't come as a great surprise, Congress has taken a pretty hands-off approach when it comes to setting cybersecurity benchmarks. In fact, until there was a Cybersecurity Act passed back in 2015, but before that, it had been more of a decade since Congress had really acted in this regard. And that act that was passed back in 2015 was mostly to do with information sharing, so immunizing companies from liability that choose to share information about cyber threats or attacks with the government. So a lot of the action instead has been in the executive branch under the Obama administration and also at the states. So, for example, California and New York have both passed either, in the case of California, a new version of their data breach notification law that sets, among other things, some reasonable cybersecurity standards, including in the Internet of Things context, which is a bit of a big deal considering how big California's economy is and how many of these tech companies are located there. And similarly, New York, just earlier this year, so we're only talking about a month ago now, issued a new regulation for companies to audit and regularly test their security measures, as well as requiring things like multi-factor authentication that a lot of us are becoming more and more familiar with. That's a big deal because that impacts all the finance companies in New York, but also all the businesses that do business with those finance companies. So that could have some ripple effects pretty quickly.
We've talked here about the state and the federal levels. You mentioned about initiatives that were passed by Congress during the Obama administration. It's early to tell what's going to likely happen in the Trump administration, but since Donald Trump is a businessman, certainly very savvy, at least on social media, do you think that any indications from the new administration that they're going to beef up the efforts to set up cybersecurity, or are we going to just basically see more of the same?
It's a bit too soon to tell for sure. We've had some different versions of a draft executive order leaked with regards to cybersecurity over the past month or so. And the way that order is written, honestly, that could have been the next order that the Obama administration would have issued as well. So it really was kind of a bit of more of the same with regards to, for example, spreading awareness and the use of this cybersecurity framework that I mentioned earlier to help instill what that standard of care should be, and requiring just simply more from cabinet-level officials to be responsible, to be accountable for the security of their own systems, things like that. We have seen as well different agencies of government become a little bit more involved with this, like the Federal Trade Commission, the FCC as well, has a different cybersecurity and privacy safeguards. You might have read in the news that the Senate has just decided to overturn the Obama administration FCC policies with regard to privacy, especially for internet service providers. So that's kind of up in the air, depending what the House and what President Trump does. But the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is still pretty active when it comes to helping set cybersecurity benchmarks for firms. So far, they've really gone after just the most egregious cases of companies not protecting consumer data. A great case like that was Wyndham Hotels, where just thousands and thousands of consumers had lost their information. The company had made very little effort to safeguard it. And as a result, they set some requirements for that company as part of a public settlement order that's now being followed by lots of other companies, just so that they don't get charged as well in a similar case. So, potentially that kind of thing could continue, but it's going to be up to the new FTC commissioner.
Scott Shackelford is an assistant professor for business law and ethics at the Kelley School of Business at IU in Bloomington, and he recently put out an article that is available to look at on the Conversation website talking about how companies can stay ahead of the cybersecurity curve. And Professor Shackelford, thank you very much for being with us, and we appreciate your comments, and we hope to see more articles in the Conversation about these things.
No, thank you again, and hope you have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you. Leah Nahemus is the Director of Programs at Indiana Humanities, which had just launched a new statewide two-year thematic initiative called Quantum Leap that includes programs, grants, and resources that would help celebrate Hoosier ingenuity in the STEM fields. STEM, of course, being science, tech, technology, engineering, and math. And she told us recently here on Regionally Speaking that there are some events through the initiative that are also going to be specifically aimed at Northwest Indiana.
We here at Indiana Humanities design programs around themes, and we try to change up our themes every couple of years. So as you can imagine, the last 2 years we've been really focused on the bicentennial, and one of the things that we kept hearing as we were going around the state with our next Indiana theme, which was all about what do Hoosiers envision for the future of the state, was how important people felt like the science and technology, certainly as a sector of our economy, as kind of a way forward for our state after, you know, kind of being a traditional industrial economy for a long time, that was really important. I think that we also had a sense that, you know, we have so many changes happening in our lives right now because of changes in science and technology, and we don't always have time to reflect or really understand what those changes mean, how they change the ways that we relate to each other, what kinds of ethical questions they raise. So we thought that all of these reasons were a good reason for us to engage Hoosiers in a statewide conversation around the ways that science and technology are reshaping our lives and communities.
Well, it sounds like, too, that some of the discussions that are going to come about, not only from the programs that the Quantum Leap Initiative is going to offer to Hoosiers and those of us here in Northwest Indiana in particular, but also, I guess, this discussion, we're just going to be delving into morals and ethics as well, too. It's, you're not going to shy away from many topics, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. So in the humanities, they give us great tools for talking about things that we disagree with or that we're unsure of. And in fact, sometimes I think what they allow us to do is to say, I'm not sure, I need to think about this and talk it all out. So that's part of what the humanities do. And I think questions, you know, we have a program coming up on May 9th that I'm really excited about. Mm-hmm. We work with a steering committee of leaders from, you know, universities and scientists and companies that are engaged in science and technology. And one of the questions that kept coming up in our discussions was the ways in which the public sometimes doesn't understand scientific evidence, and that a lot of the debates that we have about science are really come down to the question of evidence and facts and how do we believe or know what we know or believe what we believe. So things like, is climate change real? Are GMOs dangerous? Should I vaccinate my child? These are all questions that are really, when they come down to it, about the nature of evidence and how we know what we know. So we thought it would be really fun to have a statewide conversation on that topic. So on May 9th, which is a Tuesday, we're having a statewide event called Chew on This. And Chew on This is basically a simultaneous dinner party that happens in multiple restaurants at once. And one of our sites will be up in the region. And you can go on our website and see more information about this. But it'll be basically an open-ended conversation about these questions about evidence and facts and reliability and validity and things like that that are really both about how we know things in the sciences but also how we know things in the humanities. And, of course, you know, this is a topic that's top of mind for lots of people right now and fits really perfectly with our thematic initiative.
Well, before we had a conversation, I had a chance to kind of glance through the schedule of some of the events that are coming up during the two-year initiative. And before this May 9th group dinner, if you want to call it that, in discussion, there's also one that's going to happen in Indianapolis, maybe worth making the trek down to Butler University on April 20th to attend as part of, I guess, of an in-conversation series. Tell us who's going to be speaking at that, what they're going to talk about.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We're going to be able to welcome the author, Alan Lightman, who is really famous for writing a book called Einstein's Dreams. He's actually a physicist. He teaches at MIT, but he's one of these incredible people who also writes novels and fiction. So he kind of combines the humanities with STEM, which is what we're all about. So this book is really famous. It's imagining what would Albert Einstein be thinking about as he's coming up with the theory of relativity. But it gets into both, you know, kind of the physical world and the metaphysical world and the idea of creativity. Where do our creative ideas come from? Which is really kind of an exploration of science and the arts and the humanities. So that's one of several events we'll be doing as part of the In Conversation series. We're working with a poet who's from Indianapolis. He has a new volume called Map to the Stars. He is a Pulitzer Prize nominee. His name's Adrian Mateka. We're going to be doing an event with him. August, as part of Gen Con, which is the big gaming festival that's in Indianapolis, we're welcoming an experimental game designer named Tracy Fullerton here, and that's going to be really fun. She has designed a digital online game based on Henry David Thoreau's book Walden, and it's really unlike any kind of game. It just explodes the notion of what a game is, as well as, frankly, what a book is, right? So we're kind of excited to do some events over the coming year that explore these intersections between the humanities and science, technology, et cetera.
Sounds like a great series of conversations coming up here. Like you say, that they're going to look into STEM research and bring those together and then how they fit in together with the humanities. Interesting. We're talking with Aaliyah Namias, who is the director of programs for the new statewide two-year thematic initiative called Quantum Leap that includes programs like the ones you've heard about here and other things, grants, other resources that will be made available to communities, and also radio. In fact, we've offered one of the features up that we will be hearing more of during the initiative on Quantum Leap. Tell us how some of these radio vignettes ideas have come about, Leah, and in turn, how they're going to be turned out that people get to hear. They will hear here on Regionally Speaking.
Indiana Humanities is creating a series of short stories, audio stories, that will be broadcast on air, including at Lakeshore Public Media, as well as released as podcasts. We're calling them Quantum Leap Soundbites, and they're all stories about moments of scientific discovery or innovation in Indiana history as well as in the present of Indiana. Indiana has an incredible legacy of inventions and inventors, so we started looking for stories that maybe were a little less well-known. I think a lot of us know the story of Neil Armstrong and the man on the moon, but they might not know, in the very first episode, is all about a lab in Bloomington in the 1940s. A Holocaust refugee was relocated. At the time, Indiana University was hiring lots of Jewish scientists who were fleeing Europe from the Nazis. So they came to Bloomington. This guy basically discovers, he has an insight about how bacteria reproduce, and this leads to all of this genetics research. So he kind of is a father of genetics. A lot of people know about Watson and Crick, who discovered the structure of DNA. He was the teacher of James Watson, who was a student at IU. So that story is really, really important. He went on to win a Nobel Prize for his research, and a lot of Hoosiers don't know that story. So that's the kind of story that we want to tell as part of this series. So we're picking stories. We're working with an amazing producer who has been doing all this great research. We've also been working with some of our friends who are in the history community to tell us what stories we may not know about. So that's how it's come about, and we're very excited about it. It's an experiment for us.
Speaking of stories, let's talk about the One State, One Story, and that's an interesting concept that will come about with the discussions and presentations, one big presentation in particular that's going to happen in Indianapolis in September. The novel is Frankenstein. How did Frankenstein come into the picture that is going to be mentioned in the Quantum Leap Initiative?
So Indiana Humanities is partnering with the Indiana State Library on a statewide read of Frankenstein. So if you're not familiar with Frankenstein, you probably know like the image of the creature from the Munsters. But what you may not know is that it is the best book that's ever been written about scientific discovery and invention and kind of what can go wrong if you're not careful. Because, of course, the Frankenstein is not actually the monster or the creature. It's the inventor. It's the scientist. It's Dr. Frankenstein who creates them. And it's all about, you know, his excitement and his zeal to invent a new type of life. But then that life comes to life, and there are all kinds of unintended consequences. The book turns 200 in 2018, so we thought this is a great book to read and think about the questions that surround science and its role in society, but it's also a great chance to celebrate an incredible book. You know, a lot of people also don't know it was written by a teenage girl. There's so many pieces of Frankenstein. So we're going to be doing all kinds of stuff. So in the fall, libraries and schools and community organizations can apply to us for funding. We'll send you book sets so that you can organize a read of the program, of the book in your community. We'll be doing other kinds of events, including a big festival and readathon here in Indianapolis at the Indiana Medical History Museum, which is this incredible place that has like brains in jars and things like that. So perfect place to read Frankenstein. So we're really excited about that, and more information about that is on our website, indianahumanities.org, as well as more information will be coming out over the next several months leading up to that 2018 anniversary.
Interesting. Now, in addition to what you'll find out when you go onto the website and learn in general about the Quantum Leap programs, there in particular is one here in Northwest Indiana that you'll have a chance to enjoy some fresh air and ecology, by as well as the connection between the humanities and STEM. And that is a field trip, which one of several, I guess, around the state. But tell us about the one that's going to happen here in Northwest Indiana.
As part of Quantum Leap, we are taking adults on field trips. We're calling them Quantum Leap field trips to sites of scientific inquiry and investigation. So laboratories, observatories, research facilities. And one of the places that I am obsessed with is the Indiana Dunes. So a lot of people think of the Indiana Dunes as a place for recreation or for artistic inspiration, but they are also a living laboratory. They are the place where Henry Chandler Coles basically proved a theory of ecological succession, and there's ongoing research that happens there today because it's such a unique ecosystem, such a unique landscape. And so we're going to be going and really thinking about it as a laboratory, as a place where a scientific theory was proven and how we can observe and do that. We're actually going to get a chance to do some testing along the way and some collecting of evidence. And then we're going to have a conversation, because one of the ideas that Henry Chandler Coles really unleashed into the world is this idea of the interconnectedness of all living things, right? That's kind of what ecology is about. I'm going to put that in very humanities terms. Mm-hmm. But that idea that we're all interconnected, and if you change one part of the system, it affects other things, that's an idea that is also an idea in our culture, not just in science. So that's kind of where we're going to bring in the humanities piece of it.
Once again, that is coming up at the Indiana Dunes, and it's going to be on September 16th, so mark your calendar. And, of course, you can always check the Quantum Leap page on the Indiana Humanities website to find out more particulars about that. The Indiana Dunes, yeah, definitely is a laboratory. In fact, as it turned out to be that way for some IU Northwest professors who are doing some investigative work after the Mount Baldy sand dune collapse and swallowed mm-hmm. up a young man who luckily survived his encounter with the sand dune. But they were trying to figure out, well, why did this sinkhole begin? How did it get started? And that's how the Indiana Dunes turned out to show itself as a true ecological laboratory. It's interesting how these things can kind of turned out that way. Leah, tell us how people can find out more about the Quantum Leap website.
Yes, so please visit indianahumanities.org, and when you go there, you'll see the link to go see everything there is to be about Quantum Leap. So you can learn more about our Frankenstein programming, about our field trip, about that upcoming event in May called Chew on This. We'll also be doing some grant making, so there are opportunities for you to invent and imagine your own public program that combines the STEM and humanities fields, so you can learn more about those grants on our website, and let us know what you think.
That is Leah Namias, who is the Director of Programs at the Indiana Humanities, talking about Quantum Leap, which is a new statewide initiative that celebrates human Hoosier ingenuity in the STEM fields. The Urban League of Northwest Indiana's Diversity Awards Luncheon is an important opportunity for businesses and organizations around the region to demonstrate and be recognized for the ways in which they make diversity an asset that's integral to their success. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore attended the event.
The keynote speaker for the 5th Annual Diversity and Inclusion Awards Luncheon for the Northwest Indiana Urban League was the Chicago Urban League CEO, Sherry Runner. She says the best thing you can do to fight racism is to speak up when you see it or hear it. The CEO of the Urban League in Northwest Indiana, Dr. Vanessa Allen, says this event serves as a call to action to increase diversity in our community.
We want people to go back to their organizations, go back to their companies, and take a self-assessment and look at their board of directors and look at their staff and find out, are there ways to increase the diversity on those corporations and on those boards? We want them to go out and stop those people who are talking in, quote, codes. When you hear some negative talk and it's ethnicity wrong, then we want you to shut that down. And we thank everyone for leaving here, going back out and doing the work that's needed.
The Urban League also recognized those organizations and individuals that serve as the best examples of diversity. Awards were given for work in the community, leadership, workforce diversity, working with youth, and the Moving the Needle Forward Award.
Their proactiveness to have a diverse outreach in their community or in terms of their leadership or in terms of their employees that work for them.
Their Lifetime Achievement Award was given to former Gary Mayor Richard Hatcher. State Senator Eddie Melton says the work of the Urban League is invaluable.
When we look at the body of work that the Urban League of Northwest Indiana has been doing over the years, from education to scholarships, but when we look at how they've been able to bring the conversation of diversity and inclusion to the table and have, I remember this event a few years ago was just a couple of hundred people, now we're at 500 and moving out of this room. I have to just commend them for not just having this as a one-time event, but actually walking the walk and talking the talk.
In Maryville, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The next Valparaiso University Soup Bowls for the Hungry will be held on campus this coming weekend. It's the annual fundraising effort that is organized by Valparaiso University art professor Michelle Carrazzo. Please tell us about the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser and how it got started.
I teach at Valparaiso University, and I didn't exactly think of using that as a venue at first. I'd thought about it for years. This is a national program called the Empty Bowl Project that potters participate in it by their own choice. And it's all informal. Every potter runs it differently. So I was looking for sponsors, and then I thought, why not use the university and the students? And that was a number of years ago now, maybe six.
Wow.
And I had little expectations. Our advertising is kind of minimal. Our budget is certainly nothing. And it was just kind of the spirit of it. And the students actually enjoyed it very much. They make the work, the bulk of the work that's sold, and then the faculty also contributes. And then we have a silent auction that's open to the public. So it turned out to be very, very fun. We also opened the pottery studio to people who might try to make a pot, which is very difficult to do, but they have a lot of fun.
Well, some people have probably better luck at that than others, so I suppose it just depends on the particular skill of the individual there at the pottery wheel.
Yeah, early on, there isn't too much skill. It's just, it's a machine that you have to conquer, a little bit like riding a bike for the first time.
How many bowls are you hoping that you'll be able to auction off here in the silent auction for the Bowls for the Hungry? And how many did you have last year that you were able to successfully auction off and raise money on?
Well, we auction them all. They all go. And there should be about 50 bowls, and some are very beautiful. Some are kind of silly and fun. Some are non-functional. We get a nice array. And we ask a minimum bid of $5, and then it just goes up from there.
That's great. What was the best bid that you received on a bowl in the ones past that seemed to have helped out the most maybe in reaching the fundraising goal that you might have set?
Well, there's always, we always look to that to see who gets the highest. Mm-hmm. It's not always a teacher. Sometimes it's a student. I think usually the highest bids go around $100. That's kind of like coup. That's a special thing to have it. And sometimes it's a parent coming in to get their child's work.
Now, in getting this project together initially, you came up and you had success because obviously now you're into another year of the Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser. What's the plan for this year? What is the fundraiser going to raise money for?
The fundraiser will donate all of its money to Women in Bloom, which is an organization I hadn't heard of. But, every year people come and they suggest organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was one suggested last year that I'm following up on. It's to help women get jobs. It's and they do it through scholarships and mentoring. And what I read about it says that they help women veterans and women that are underserved. So it sounds like a very, very nice program.
A lot of organizations like the Food Bank for Northwest Indiana are ones that you and your associates that set up the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser want to help. And you mentioned this year in particular, it's women in need of jobs.
Yes, always. That is the Empty Bowl Project, to help the underserved or the people who need help. Whether it's a food pantry, one year we helped we sent our money through the university to the tsunami that hit Japan. One year we sent it down to, I think it's Henry County in southern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Their library was completely destroyed by a tornado. We do. I guess we do try to keep it local, though. Most of the others have been organizations in either Gary or Porter County.
Now, this year's annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser is going to happen on Friday the 31st. It'll be from 4 until 6 p.m., and it'll be held in the Arts and Psychology Building, and that's at Mound and Linwood Streets in Valparaiso. Is it an easy place where people can come in and park and enjoy the fundraiser?
Yes, a little bit. If they know the university, right beside it is a big parking lot available to the public after certain times. And so it's a little bit tucked away on the west side of the campus, but not impossible.
Michelle Carrazzo is at Valparaiso University, and she's helping organize this year's annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser. Again, it's coming up on Friday, March 31st, and it'll be in the Art and Psychology Building on the VU campus. Thanks very much for telling us about it, Michelle. Good luck, and hope that you have lots of bowls to be able to auction off, and a lot of people show their support for programs that'll help out each time that you have this annual event. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Gloria Tuohy, the founder and CEO of Indiana Ballet Theater. And Gloria, you have so many things going on all the time. I don't know how you manage it all.
Yes. Fortunately, I have a daughter that's also the other artistic director.
So. Oh, she's your artistic director now.
She joins with me.
I see.
We are a partnership.
You're co-artistic, co-directors.
Co-artistic directors,
well,
yes.
That's good, because yes. You need some help, I think,
yes.
In the sense of time management. So first of all, you're teaching. You're busy with performances that you're producing.
Yes.
And then you have this huge project underway, the Classical Arts Center.
Yes.
And, well, let's start with the performances. The Kaleidoscope is coming up soon.
We have Kaleidoscope, our modern contemporary review, and that's the first time it's being done at the center in Munster. So I hope people will come out for that.
Now you're going to have to crawl all over the set for whatever show is on stage at that time, or are they going to clear it off for you?
Well, I think they're clearing it off.
Oh, so I hope so.
I think we've got enough room.
They
did ask us how much room we wanted, however.
Oh,
so
that's
we'll
good.
See.
That's good. Well, that'll be a good spot for you. I think you should. That's a good audience market for you, I think.
We hope so. It's a new audience, and they actually reached out to us when Star Plaza was going to close down.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So they wanted us to come there. So we decided to take the modern one there first and see how that.
Had you been doing Kaleidoscope at the Star Plaza?
No, we'd been doing Kaleidoscope at sometimes the Toll Theatre, sometimes Valparaiso University, Memorial Opera House, smaller
you've
theaters.
You've moved it around.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good move because to give you some more exposure on the western side of Lake County.
Right.
Yeah. And over, penetrating into south suburbs, too.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and,
real good.
And Amanda is the choreographer and director of that show, and she's done a great job with new exciting work, so I hope people will come out for that.
And then you have Cinderella at the Star Plaza Theater.
Yes, we have Cinderella at the Star Plaza. This is our 20th year, still our 20th year. And so Cinderella was one of our first ballets we've ever done, so we've done it many times, and it's the most successful.
When is that coming up?
That's April the 11th.
So close together.
Yeah. We have already sold the school field trip out. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, just 10 days apart. So
do you alternate with Sleeping Beauty?
No, we have 9 ballets. So we'll be doing Swan Lake in 2018. So,
so several
we have a different
ones that you
spring
have
ballet each time. Nutcracker comes back, but spring is always different.
Well, and the big news is that you recently received title to the old nurses' dormitory building. I never know what to call it exactly.
It was a dormitory, so it's a good word to call
good
it.
Good word to use. Well, back in the days when people were still suffering with TB a lot, and there was a TB sanatorium right on the corner there of 93rd and Main. So the nurses lived in the building that you have now received title to.
They did, yes.
After and that was like over the course of 11 or 12 years that you had.
Yeah, 11 years.
11.
We didn't start any work on it until 2012. So it's been since then, and we've spent $500,000 on the exterior. And now we've got the we've got a loan coming from Tech Credit Union, mm-hmm. and everything's moving forward. We're getting the conceptual drawings done right now. Be ready in a week, and it goes out to bid.
Goodness.
And it's got the possibility of opening in November of 2017.
This November?
Mm-hmm.
Really? That's going to be a major undertaking. So let's tell everybody what's going to be inside the building real quick. We're going to
Ballet Theater will be on the top floor.
Mm-hmm.
Many other arts, possibly social arts. On the center floor. And the lower floor will have a black box theater, mm-hmm. Bistro, reception, mm-hmm. and stores.
And you have designs for both the interior and exterior in terms of landscaping.
Yes, yes. We may need just a little bit more land for the parking, but other than that, it's going out to tea room and gardens and natural playground and hopefully an outside performing area also.
Mm-hmm. It's an ambitious project, to be sure. But, you know, it's great that there's going to be there's a major arts project underway. I think that's fantastic for Northwest Indiana.
And we'll save the history of the building. It's on the historic registry. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, good. Congratulations on getting the title. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, you're perseverant, Gloria. I always say you're like Mary Poppins. You just believe in miracles. And
it will happen.
Exactly. A spoonful of
sugar. Don't give up.
Okay, Gloria. Well, good luck with everything and keep us posted.
Okay.
Thanks for being here. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
John Kane talking with Gloria Tui about the Indiana Ballet Theater's renovation project. Tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. You can, of course, catch them as well, too, on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow with a conversation with a Hammond native who is now a member of the Purdue University faculty, a former U.S. ambassador to Belize who's picked up a big honor for being a top journalism educator. That and more coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.